Blog Talk Radio.
So then I thought, you know, that we would talk about you being a Red Sox fan living in New York.
That's cool. My only fear, and I could be irrational about this, is that, like, I just hear this ringing, and I can probably go through without it driving me nuts, but if it gets picked up in the sound, well, I guess if you don't hear it.
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't hear it at all. So as long as you don't go nuts and start chopping your ears off.
But, Brendan, you hear it too?
I do, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, that's fine. That's great. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, if spring training hasn't driven us nuts already, then this should be fine.
This is, by the way, the 122nd Over the Monster podcast. I am Matt Corey. This is Portland, Oregon, where I am. And I am joined today by Brendan O'Toole, who is alive and not covered in snow in beautiful Massachusetts. Is that correct, Brendan?
Yeah, the snow is actually almost gone because it's magically been over 50 degrees for like two straight days. None of us know what to do with ourselves.
Well, run naked through the streets is the answer to that.
Well, yeah, that too, but it's still slippery.
Also joined today, for the first time, I believe, by Over the Monster contributor and writer at The Classical and probably other places that I don't know about, Brian Joyner. Brian, what's up, man?
Hey, it's nice to be here. Yeah, I write for places. I don't even know all of them right now.
That's fine. That's fine.
But, it's even less snowy here in Brooklyn.
And it's even less snowy here in Portland. So there.
There you go.
We have the snow continuum on this podcast, which is certainly going to get us lots of listeners. But then again, if we cared about listeners, I mean, I care about the people who listen. I don't necessarily care about getting more people to listen is what I should say.
And you have me on the show, so you have proof to back that up.
That's right. So welcome. I think that this being spring training... Oop, everyone still there?
Yep.
Okay. Skype makes weird noises every now and again, and it always freaks me the hell out. I was thinking that since this is spring training and there's nothing happening with the Red Sox, which is good for the most part, other than the great outfield logjam of 2015 is starting to maybe be alleviated a little bit. But before we get into that, Brian, I understand you have, if I can totally unfairly put you on the spot, you have some sort of general thoughts about the Red Sox this season. Is that more or less correct?
Yeah, it's true. I've been thinking a lot about it and been working up a preview that who knows what will happen with that. But, I mean, the analogy I've come up with is sort of out of our childhood. Remember Mike Tyson's Punch-Out?
Yes.
If you played it the whole time, once you got to Mike Tyson, the first 90 seconds, the first round, you had to dodge the uppercut. You weren't even fighting back. It was just straight up dodging the uppercut.
Right.
And what I have said in something that is as yet unpublished and long-winded is that the Red Sox in 2012 and 2014 basically just didn't dodge the uppercut. They never even got to the point where they would be fighting back against the league. There's sort of the things inherent in baseball, both from the administrative level, where the players you have can have career years 1 year and then just be, you know, really subpar or more injured the next year, as far as putting together the team, and then just as far as the rest of the league just pounding on you, that they basically just got knocked out, which honestly, sort of a good way to...
Yeah.
To have a losing season, if you're going to lose, you might as well lose big. But I think this year, the entirety of sort of my preview was that they they, by adding about 70 number two starters, and then Hanley and Pablo Sandoval, they basically just, they have a chin now. And in this division, that might be all they need.
They are not Glass Joe, is what you're saying.
They're no longer Glass Joe.
I think that's good, and I feel the need at this point to say that, although I never won Mike Tyson's punch out, I did get to Mike Tyson, and I did last the entire fight without getting knocked out, and then you lose on TKO automatically. But I felt a strong sense of accomplishment at that point.
That's like an Orioles season, I guess. Not the last 3 years, because, you know, I say that, and then I looked at the Orioles records the last 3 years, and they've been pretty good.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, that's not what we're going for. We want to, you know, we want to win.
Right.
I actually, you know, I really think there's an argument that it worked to our advantage. We sort of we got knocked down so many times early in 2012, 2014 that we just hit reset and just, let's just start it again. And when you look at 2013, there's a tendency to think, oh, well, it happened, you know, they won it like that. And, you know, everyone had bounce back seasons. People had career years. It was great. Everything worked out. And they say, well, you know, the odds are that won't happen again. And I suppose that's true, but it could. And they certainly have enough talent. And so I'm pretty optimistic about the team.
Yeah, I am too. Sorry, Brendan is alerting me that I may be the cause of some noise here, and I don't know how to fix it.
I think you have a separate call trying to call both of us.
How am I doing that?
I don't know.
I don't know, but...
And I tried to hang up that call, and it hangs up this one.
Yeah, that's bizarre. Okay, so here's what I'm going to do, and I apologize to the listeners, and you're just going to have to bear with us, but I'm going to hang up on both Brandon and Brian, and I will sever all communication with you both, and then I will immediately call you right back.
Okay.
Hopefully that will solve whatever problem there is here. So, all right, I will speak with you both momentarily.
All right.
Okay, so I'm reconnected potentially, and now I'm going to add people. I'm going to add Brendan, and I'm going to add Brian. Hello? Hello?
Hello.
Oh my God, that feels so much better.
Yeah, that fixed it.
I'm very glad, and I think we're still recording. It asked me
if not, we're just going to talk about the Red Sox.
Oh, fine.
I mean, what else would we talk about?
I don't know. Brooklyn ripping off Portland all the time. You can talk about that. That'd just be contentious, and there's really no need for that.
There, well, do you think I'm going to argue?
That's fair.
No, man. No, that's totally true. That's totally true. East Coast bias. Yeah, you know.
All right. So apologies to the listeners. I hope you've all stuck with us. Hopefully the sound is better now. I am notoriously awful at this, this being podcasting. In any case, back to the Red Sox, the common thread that brings us all together on this Thursday morning. And it's still morning here, so I can say that. So, Brian, you were using a particularly humorous analogy, I felt, of the video game Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. I mean, it brings up sort of an interesting question as far as the way the Red Sox seasons has gone over the last like 3 years, and you can even really look back farther than that if you want to. And I'll throw this open to both of you. I mean, do you feel like the Red Sox have been extraordinarily lucky? And when I say lucky, I mean both in a good and a bad sense. Over those last 3 years, or have we just sort of misrepresented the quality of those teams that they had during that time? Brian, I'll ask you.
Go ahead. Oh, okay. Yeah, they. I think that there are a lot of things happening with the way the Red Sox have seesawed so violently. I think all the teams were well put together, but they were also easy to disassemble in some ways if they needed to be. Probably more so last year's team. Than 2012, which was just sort of an emotional meltdown, it was Bobby V, so that'll happen. I also do think that, last year's team was really bad, and I think what we see with both the Red Sox and the Giants, who are an easy example because they win every other year, that it's not just... You can turn your team around a lot in an offseason, and the Red Sox did it in both the offseason following 2012 and this offseason. And then on top of that, given the unbalanced schedule, your quality of opponent can change drastically as well, so that in the division you can make up a lot of games in a hurry that is not linear with only your own improvement. And all the projections I've seen predict the AL East to be like a slog. I think Fangraphs had the Red Sox at 86 wins in first and the Orioles at 79 in fifth. So it's really bunched together right now. And I think the bigger factor is you just need to make the playoffs. And the Red Sox, for everything that happened last year, they're in the position now to start the season that they might be the best team, but they certainly, I think, have the best assets. And throughout the year, if we're going to look at what they could become, you know, if they hit a pivot point this year where they have to go for it or want to sell anything off, though I don't know what they'd do in that case, they can certainly get talent if they need it. Though Cliff Lee, a little disheartening just on a baseball level, not just a tax level, that what's happening to him. But I think they're in a good position now and could be in a better position going forward.
Brendan, when you look at the 2013 team, it's really not too different than the 2014 team. You know, they tried the same thing with Middlebrooks. They had a different catcher who in theory hit for power and didn't get on base. Johnny Gomes played probably more than Johnny Gomes should. I guess, one big difference is, Jacoby Ellsbury. But beyond that, it's not extraordinarily different. I mean, I know this is 2015, but I just find this question interesting. I mean, did we way overestimate the quality of the 2013 team? Did they really get lucky in 2013 and really get unlucky in 2014?
Well, I mean, part of it is just the basics of any team that wins the World Series got lucky on some level.
It's good.
They had, you look at the 2013 team compared to 2014. You mentioned Ellsbury, and he was certainly a big loss, but the other one, it's not just they lost Ellsbury, they lost Victorino all year.
Right.
Which on, what was it? According to Baseball Reference, the two of them combined were 12 wins.
Yeah.
Those two alone not being on the team anymore was that much of a hit. Victorino was on the team, but he was 40 games worth of Jane Victorino. And the offense cratered because Bradley wasn't ready to hit in the big leagues, and Bogaerts had a horrible slump in the middle of the year. Middlebrooks never hit. Pedroia was injured all year. So, that was part of it. And then the other part is, especially looking how bad the 2012 team was and how bad the 2014 team was at the end, both of those teams gave up in the middle of the year.
Yeah.
Not that they weren't playing hard, but management traded half the team in both of those years. The 2012 team you know, finished with 69 wins, but that was because they went 9-20 in August and 7-19 in September after they traded everybody away. The same with the entire pitching staff, which generally doesn't help a team.
Well, so let's move this forward then, because you know you bring up interesting points about you know the health of the players and a lot of those guys. Well, the health of the players and you know the lack of you know ready for prime time you know ness. How's that for a sentence? Of the rookies, you know Bradley and Bogarts and Middlebrooks. It strikes me that you know that the Red Sox are you know kind of doing this again in a certain way. I mean, Middlebrooks is gone; he's in San Diego, and you know Bradley. If Bradley plays, it's going to be because of injuries, and I think we'd all expect a lot less out of him than what was expected last season. But you know, the Red Sox are still going into this season depending on young players, you know, pretty much to the extent that they were last year. I mean, Christian Vasquez is going to be the starter at catcher. There are real questions about whether or not he can hit major league pitching. You know, Xander Bogaerts is going to be the starter at shortstop. I think there's real questions about, I say this as a person who's firmly in, you know, the Bogaerts is going to be a star camp, but you know, last year he didn't hit that well. And you know, his fielding is a little iffy there as well. You know, and then you've got, of course, Mookie Betts, who was fantastic last season and looks good in spring training, but is 22 years old and, you know, has whatever he has, 120 plate appearances at the major league level. And on top of that, you've got Rusney Castillo, who is older but has even less, I believe, plate appearances at the major league level. Is this some sort of a fatal flaw again, or is there reason to believe that this is a different thing for some reason, and it can be successful? Brian, I'm asking you.
I think that there's a good reason to think that it won't all go bad. I mean, I emailed you about this, like, and I looked back, like, 3 years ago we were coming off a season where Daniel Bard was amazing in relief. That was 3 years ago. 2 years ago, we were excited for Jackie Bradley Jr., like, over the moon. And then last year, we're like, Xander Bogaerts is going to be Rookie of the Year. He's going to walk away with it.
So we don't have any idea what we're talking about, is what you're saying.
Well, that is a given. Anyone who's listened this far knows that. but I think that it's not about – I mean, sure, if the rookies do great – if the young guys do great, it's great for the team. But I think – more to the point, they are to be supplemental to Napoli returning to form, and then guys like Sandoval and Hanley, who are just going to hit. I mean, Sandoval will swing at everything, but they will hit the ball, and I feel like it's to that. You know, they're toppings. And also, for as much as I talked about prospects, I do think that Betts is going to be fine, and I think Betts is going to be I'm not actually worried about him producing at all. You know, Bogaerts, we looked at to be an immediate star, and maybe it's just going to take him longer to hit. I mean, it happens. But I think Betts will be fine, and a fine all-around player from the beginning. So I think the lineup's just a lot deeper, so they don't have to rely on young guys as much.
I throw the same thing to you, Brendan.
So, I mean, same basic thing is you're not looking at these guys to be the core of the lineup. I mean, last year, I mean, you had Bogaerts and Middlebrooks and Bradley were all expected to be, you know, starting fixtures in the lineup and in the field. And this year, yeah, you're starting Vasquez. On the other hand, you know, last year he basically out-hit Pierzynski and wasn't a jerk and was good at defense. So, like, you know, worst case, you've got a really good defensive catcher, and that's kind of fine, especially nowadays. Like, we're all looking forward to, you know, Blake Swihart rising out of Pawtucket immediately and becoming the next Jason Veritek for a decade and a half, but they don't need him to be that yet. They don't need Vasquez to do that. They just need Vasquez to be really good defensively for a year. That's right. So they've got a healthy Pedroia. They've got a Mike Napoli who can actually sleep.
I think that's a good
thing. They've got Victorino back and looking decent. Yeah, it's right. Like a Napoli who can actually sleep through the night, it's going to be probably a little bit more productive. You've got David Ortiz, who's still David Ortiz. And now you've got, Hanley and Pablo, who have actually just in the game they're playing right now, Pittsburgh brought in the bullpen to face Ortiz, Ramirez, and Sandoval. And on, like, 5 pitches, the result was home run, ringing double home run. That's not going to happen all year, but a lot of it's going to happen all year. They've got enough guys in the lineup who are going to hit.
Go ahead, sorry.
I'm sorry, what?
No, you go ahead.
So they've got enough guys. Yep, they've got enough guys in the lineup who are going to hit that, you know, if Bogaerts scuffles a little bit more, won't matter as much because he's got some healthy big producers around him. I think that was the thing last year, all of the rookies had to hit in order for the offense to do anything. And partly that was just because injuries destroyed some of the main producers, but it was a double whammy of like everybody got hurt and the prospects didn't turn out. That could still happen this year. You know, I mean, injuries are always a risk, but it seems less likely given the guys they've brought in and the guys who have apparently gotten healthy again.
Yeah, I think that's fair. So let's move to the outfield, which, we always hear the baseball cliche, you know, it'll sort itself out. And a lot of times, sort of bizarrely, it does. We've got Steve Castillo has an oblique injury, and those things are really sticky.
It wasn't Mookie Betts. I mean, even as high as I was on Jackie Bradley Jr., I think that Betts is really there. You know, we're right to be skeptical about prospects and not put the cart before the horse, but Mookie Betts looks like he just was born to just play baseball and play it well. And I feel like he will be in short order. I mean, this is the hope. The hope is in short order. He's the guy that everything rotates around, and that if you have an outfield logjam, you are basically rotating people around something stable. And I have to say this now. I can barely hear you. There's something really like feedback noise.
Oh man.
Yeah, I know. It's not the same, obviously. but anyhow, yeah, I'll just keep going. No, I mean, Betts doesn't scare me, and I think that I do really think these things sort themselves out. We got a great season out of Victorino, and he's had great seasons before, but I think that we got the best Victorino we could get in 2013. And I do not necessarily think we will get it again, but I think that Red Sox fans look at it and they say, oh, well, you know, that's Shane Victorino. Well, kind of is Shane Victorino. And I think that, especially with the injury to Castillo already, it'll work itself out. My point being that we have a lot of outfielders, but I'm not sure any one is going to be so great that it causes a problem of having too many of them. And I really do think it will probably sort itself out in some way. Victorino will probably play a lot because he's Shane Victorino and he's sort of earned it. But I, you know, we'll see. It's just guesswork at this point.
Brendan, do you concur?
Yeah, and part of it also with Bradley is when we're all high on Jackie Bradley last year and he was like, yeah, no, he's going to be the starting center fielder, it's going to be great. When he faltered, the backup was Grady Sizemore, basically.
Yeah, it's true.
And then maybe Brock Holt. whereas now, you know, if Betts falters, there's Risnik Castillo. Because they'll obviously give Betts a month to figure it out. It won't be like, oh, you were 0-6 in the first two games, you're back in AAA. They'll give him a while to work out. So you've got Castillo who could come back. You've got Jackie Bradley who can fill in for a little while Betts figures things out. There's actual depth in the outfield now because they have 7 outfielders.
Right.
Which means they have 4 guys who can fill in if somebody screws up. So that's the thing. The other big issue with the 2014 Red Sox was just that complete lack of depth. Whereas now they've got a bunch of guys who could fill in at multiple positions. They've got a bunch of guys in the high minors who might be ready to take a look if they decide by May or June, yep, this one isn't working either, let's try it out. There's backup, I think, is the big thing with this year's team, which there wasn't last year.
Brendan, that's the backup thing I think is key because there's so many questions, and we've discussed this before on the podcast. There's so many questions with each of these guys, you know. But it brings me to this point, which is, you know, the easiest, I think, thing to look at and see, you know, about the roster is that Alan Craig is an extraneous piece. Now, that said, next season Shane Victorino will be a free agent, and, you know, my guess is won't be back with the Red Sox. Next season Mike Napoli will be a free agent. He may or may not be back. And David Ortiz will be a year older. Is it worth it to hold on to Alan Craig now for next season? Is there a way to shoehorn him onto the roster? Is there a spot for him here, or do they need to make a move?
The problem with Craig right now is he has no trade value. He's locked up for a while, which is great, and he's been hitting better in spring training, but it's spring training. So it's
right.
If spring training stats mattered, then the Red Sox would have been able to trade Middlebrooks and Bradley 2 years ago for Stanton, and everything would be great.
I really wish they had. I wish they'd done that.
They weren't.
That's a move that I would have liked to see.
Yeah, that would have been a lot of fun. So that's the thing, is Craig, as of now, if he looks really great in spring training and, you know, the Phillies decide, yeah, we really like Alan Craig because, well, we have Ryan Howard at first base right now, and he becomes part of a trade with them, awesome. But otherwise, he's a guy who probably would need to play to establish any value, and I don't know where he plays right now. Craig is an issue because, right, like Napoli is healthy and is the incumbent. He's going to play. If Victorino and Betts are both healthy, you don't want Craig playing over either of them, and you certainly don't want him playing in either center or right.
Yeah.
And he's not going to play over Hanley Ramirez. So I don't know where he plays, unless it's in a backup pinch-hitting role. And I don't know how much value that establishes. Craig is sort of he's a really weird spot for the Red Sox, and I feel like part of why they got him was they were more worried about Napoli than maybe they should have been.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, he after they made that trade, you know, that's when they, you know, when they signed Castillo, when, you know, Betts continued his rise through the system, and all of a sudden, you know, he became extraneous. Brian, is this some guy that they just need to dump, or is there a way to hold on to him and hope that, you know, his value, you know, it expands to the point where he might be worth something? Or do you just hold on to him in perpetuity and not, you know, not with the intent of getting rid of him, but with the intent of, you know, having a valuable player at a below market rate, you know, into the future?
Yeah, I don't think they have a choice. I think they have to do that. The one thing I'll say is that at least the one reason why I think they're just in a holding pattern is that, yeah, Napoli looks better. He can sleep, he can dream, which is important. But take this with a grain of salt. I don't want to say it, but Ortiz is 39. He is 39 years old, or he's going to be.
Right.
So something...
I don't get what you're driving at here.
Yeah, my point being that... yeah, right. Like, if we have a guy who can just hit, and we have two guys playing first and playing DH who basically just hit, one of whom has injury problems and the other of whom is 39, having a guy signed who can hit, who, even if he's not playing, who could step in if something were to happen to both of them, I don't think it's a terrible position. I don't feel like it's... I mean, maybe Alan Craig will not like it because he's not playing, but that's kind of not the Red Sox problem, unless he makes it their problem.
Right, that's the danger, right? I mean, I don't think anyone's ever accused Alan Craig of being a bad clubhouse presence, but...
Right.
You know...
Well, and I think that there wouldn't... My sense is that Alan Craig, given that the Red Sox are linked to pretty much anyone who, especially pitchers, who are, on the trade block, that he would be part of something bigger. It's possible they could do a trade where they just trade Alan Craig just to get rid of him, but at the moment, I don't see a reason to, simply for the insurance purposes of having a dude who can hit around, who's on a good contract.
Well, I'm with you both on that. The issue, I think, is roster spots. I mean, they can't roster 35 guys. They have a, 25-man limit. Mark wrote about this at Over the Monster today. They don't have room for six outfielders. Hanley and Castillo and Betts and Victorino and Nava, that's five guys right there.
Get rid of Nava.
Okay.
I know. I know. I know. I risk the Over the Monster Daniel Nava fan club, but I mean, I think Daniel Nava is a nice player.
You're damn right. He is.
Yeah, exactly. He's a nice player. The whole Daniel Nava for All-Star campaign 2 years ago made my brain bleed. Not that he was putting up good numbers. It's not the issue. But I do think that there's more room on this team for Alan Craig than there is for Daniel Nava at this point. Well, or Jackie Bradley Jr. for that matter, who I love his defense, but maybe he never hits, and maybe he never really hits.
Yeah.
And he's one of these guys, I've seen them before come up for the Red Sox and you get an emotional attachment to them. Oh, they're going to be on the Red Sox for the rest of their career. And then you look down 10 years down the line and they've played for six different teams.
Right.
It happens to everybody. And I think that Jackie Bradley Jr., sooner or later, is going to be one of those guys. And the Red Sox pick those guys up at trade deadlines. They don't hold on to them and hope for them to mature, because their team is just too talent rich at any given time, or at least that's the goal.
No, I think that's right. And it, the more I think about it, the more it does come down to a, Daniel Nava versus Alan Craig thing. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think they can send Nava back to Pawtucket. I think he's out of options. I think they have to keep him at the major league level. I mean, they both do essentially the same thing. You know, they, they're slightly different hitters, of course. But I guess Craig at his best is a little less on base and a little more power. But they both are sort of, defensively deficient corner outfield / first base / DH guys. And my guess is that, that you're right, Brian. And like Brendan said, the contract, it's not bad. But it probably makes it harder to deal him than a guy like Nava, who, is making whatever, $1 million or $2 million or whatever it is this year. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how they sort this out. And if Castillo is injured for some extended period of time, maybe he does start in AAA, and maybe that alleviates the logjam and for a little while. But I don't know. I kind of feel like I'd rather see them trade Nava than pay Castillo $12 million to play center field in AAA. So I don't know.
I do think that the one thing in the trade Craig category that is for that case is that I think people would be more likely to trade for Craig just based on his name and what they've seen him do. I think that we have really liked that Daniel Nava, but I'm not sure that there's around the league quite the same appreciation. And now that the Padres are actually trying, they do have Middlebrooks, but we can't just trade them everyone who we don't want for, whatever, which we've done for 50 years. So I don't know. It'll play itself out, and then we'll just argue about it online.
That sounds right. That's an interesting question, though. I wonder who has more trade value. I think that, Craig is a name guy, and he is, a quote-unquote all-star, player. But he was also just horrendous and injured last year. I don't know. I think there's his contract is terrific if he's a above average player. It's even fine if he's an average player. If he's hitting 150, 230, doesn't matter after that. Then it's kind of a mess. The advantage to Nava is, like I said, maybe a similar player, less upside, I suppose, but general skills and stuff, similar fit into a team.
And he hits lefty, which, is, I think that's an advantage, just in terms of lineup. I'm looking at the Baseball Prospectus book, and they seem to be very down on Alan Craig and very, okay on Nava. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that there's, we spend a lot of, I don't know how the gap is between name recognition and trade value in actual, not on talk radio, but in the real league. But I still think that there is something to be said that Alan Craig would just have more based on name recognition, even if there's no reason he should. But who knows? I think that this is just something Charrington will have to figure out in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so I want to move on to two other less pressing topics before our Blog Talk Radio hour is up. And one of those is kind of a stupid question that I'm lamely actually excited to hear your answers for this. So I'm going to throw it at you, and you guys can go back and forth. Who are you excited for most on the team this year, and who are you most afraid of this year? Or yeah, interpret that however you will. I'll throw this, I guess, at you first, Brian.
Oh, I was hoping Brendan would go first so I'd have time to think about it.
Oh, you guys can argue about it. I don't care. Go ahead.
I mean, I think that I am most excited about Mookie Betts. And I know this is going back to the well of the young players.
Yes.
But I do think it's different. I really do think he's different. And hopefully will be playing, you know, for the Sox for about a decade. So I'm excited about that. The one person I'm worried about, despite the fact I love him, and I've used him as an example of the Red Sox getting a chin, is Sandoval, who waves at a lot of pitches. You know, he swings it a lot, and I feel like he's someone, if he had a slow first month, people are going to start grumbling about him, you know, just because I've seen it happen. And the first month, with the impression of guys, is worth basically the next 4 months put together.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much it really matters, but at least as far as the team getting started, I'm worried about that. And I'm not even including Clay Buchholz in this, because what's the point? what's the point?
Yeah.
Brendan, what do you think?
I think for sheer excitement, I think Hanley, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it's been a long, long while since the Red Sox had a second ridiculous bat. You know, David Ortiz has been hitting like a, you know, depending on how close to Boston you live, Hall of Famer or borderline Hall of Famer for a decade and a half for the Red Sox now. And it's been great, but yeah, he hasn't had like a slugging buddy since Manny left. And so that's going to be really fun. Like, I just, especially given the way offense has been the last few years, and it's been a different game, and it's still been really fun to watch, but I just want all the dingers this year. I just want a ton of balls on Lansdowne Street. Like, that's, and yeah, and having Hanley and Poppy on the same. So, you know, technically it's a cop-out, because I think that Hanley, you know, powering up will make David Ortiz have a little more power and get more pitches and just generally be more fun. But yeah, I think probably Hanley on that one. And as far as worry, I will also cop out and not even bother with Buchholz, because I'm trying not to think about it. Like, let's not, yeah. But probably, and I hope just by saying it, I'm jinxing the hell out of it. It's probably Pedroia, honestly.
Ah, you're fine.
Just because. Yeah. Well, Brian stole mine.
Yeah,
so
there you go.
But yeah, I mean, like, I think, you know, he's looked healthy in spring training. He showed power in spring training. His swing looks more like it did 2 years ago. So that's all great. And even if Pedroia is not hitting all that well, he's still so good defensively, and he's such a worthwhile presence on the team, in the clubhouse, and on the field, that it's okay. But yeah, I mean, you know, there's those constant graphs of just, you know, the slugging percentage going down every single year for the last couple. So yeah, I think he can rebound, but I worry that he won't offensively. And he'll still be useful. But for one thing, if he's, you know, just useful, then it brings up, you know, sort of the uncomfortable questions of, hey, the Red Sox have Mookie Betts and Yoan Moncada, both of whom are natural second basemen.
Right.
Maybe we have to start thinking about that. And also just the basic thing with Dustin Pedroia is that his single greatest thing as far as being a ball player and being fun to watch is his single biggest weakness, which is that he never goes below 99%.
Right.
And as a second baseman, that leaves him really prone to injury. And given the damage the injury has done to his career so far, that's not great. So yeah, it's Dustin Pedroia. I will never underestimate the guy ever, but I worry about it.
No, I think that's... Go ahead, Brian.
I was just going to say, I mean, how... For me, Pedroia, you know, they're different players, obviously, but... the hand surgery, it's just all Nomar. It just, you know,
yeah.
It always comes back to Nomar for me. His hand surgery was the difference between a plaque in Cooperstown and his ESPN job. And it pretty much that's how it shakes out. Now I think they have slightly different. They're both extremely hard workers, but they have different attitudes. And I think that I'm with you. I hope by you saying it that just makes it not happen. I think he'll be fine. But you just never know. Just never know.
Yeah, absolutely. I share that worry. And I think the thing to watch for with Pedroia is. It is totally his power, like you said, Brendan, and more specifically, it's that up and in pitch, which he just turns on and hits it over the monster or into the monster. I wrote a piece last year about his declining power, and I went back and looked at where that power was, where it had been exhibited in the past and where the drop off actually came from. And it's that upper inside pitch. That he's just not turning on anymore. And I think that could be, any number of things. One is it could be declining bat speed, and the other, is it could be, the wrist thing. And I think that, we just won't know. But this is definitely a big year for Pedroia as far as, what is he going to be going forward? Is he still an above average hitter? Or like Brendan said, do we have to have the conversation? And I don't want to have that fucking conversation.
No.
But anyway.
Oh, just the Nomar thing reminded me.
Yeah, that's a scary idea.
Well, that's I read this online somewhere, and I forget who said it, Anna. So, apologies to whoever I'm not crediting properly. But somebody's line was that Nomar Garciaparra never had a 500 plate appearance season that was worth less than 6 wins.
Wow.
Which is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy. Every single... Because the dude hit, 350 every year with 25 home runs from shortstop. Just... anyway, I really miss that guy.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. All right, so to answer my own stupid question, no one cares what I think, but here it is anyway. For me, I'm most excited about David Ortiz. I found you mentioned the BP annual, Brian, and you wrote a chapter in it this year, and I heard you on the Effectively Wild podcast talking about that, and congratulations on that, by the way.
Thanks. If you squint, you might think I was talking about the Red Sox based on the colors.
But I find it interesting that, Pecota doesn't really know what to do with Ortiz at this point. I mean, there's so few comparisons for him at where he is in his career and what he's done that it's just kind of like, okay, I guess he's just going to continue to hit. So I found that kind of amusing. And that's kind of my attitude at this point, too. I spend his mid-30s, just – clutching my pearls and worried about, when Ortiz was just going to sort of drift away into nothingness and how sad we'd all be. At this point, I'm just, I'm expecting him to hit 280 and, get on base 80% or 80 points above that and slug 500 or more, just because he's David Ortiz and that's what he does. And so I'm excited to just watch him. Just crush the ball. I think that's going to be awesome. And since Brendan unceremoniously stole my Pedroia, I'm going to say the bullpen. Last year, Koji did his Koji thing, which was awesome. We got the emergence of Andrew Miller. And this year, I don't know. Koji kind of frightens me. Just the age and the way that last season ended. He's tons of fun to watch when he's on. When he's not, it's batting practice. And there's not anyone really to back him up. Tozawa is a fine, I think, reliever, but his strikeout rate is trending down. I actually heard someone say that. I haven't looked it up, so I'm repeating something that I heard someone else say there. So maybe it's wrong, but that's what I've heard. I don't know. I don't see a whole lot of depth in the pen. There's a whole lot of guys who could step up, and it could be absolutely fine. But that's my fear, is that that things just sort of go south there, and we end up with some sort of dumpster fire. I also find it interesting that none of us are really afraid of the rotation. So take that for whatever it's worth.
Well, none of us are excited about it either, and I think that's the whole point.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. Buchholz looked. Oh, I didn't see him pitch today. He pitched against the Pirates, but 3 innings, 1 run, 1 walk, 2 strikeouts. Buchholz. That's good. I'll take that. But yes, he didn't strike out 9 guys in 3 innings. All right, so we're coming up on the end of our hour, there was one other topic that I wanted to hit up with you, Brian, and that is, and I apologize, I didn't clear this with you in before, but you are a Red Sox fan and a Red Sox writer, and you live in New York City.
Yes.
What's that like?
Yeah, well, so I'll tell you a few things. One, I think I probably got, first of all, I don't know if I had a thick skin about it, but I knew what I was getting into when I moved here. And I met someone who I had never met them before. He's still a good friend of mine. And the first 3 years I lived here, which is basically 2002 to 2004, we went to pretty much every Red Sox-Yankees game in Yankee Stadium.
Oh, wow.
And I would wear Red Sox stuff. And I've never felt threatened or anything living in New York. I think people think that happens. There are a lot of Red Sox fans here, and the saddest part about it is that in neighborhoods like the one I'm in, which are a lot of people who are not from New York,
right?
There are I see more people with Red Sox gear than Mets gear, and it's not, I mean, I would say it's not close. There aren't many of both, but there are definitely more Red Sox fans.
Wow.
Certainly the Red Sox winning all the time has softened everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there are it's a common thing here. I still do get some comments. People will just scream from across the street like the Red Sox suck or something. But people here are just used to it, and with their two teams just not being inspiring, it's not a big deal, really. People, I get more crap about Giants Patriots actually, because that is something newer that they can never take away.
Right.
That they're still very happy about. But yeah, it's not as big a deal as I think as people think it is, or as big a deal as it once was, or even as big a deal as when I first moved here. And certainly when I was at the Aaron Boone game, I was in the Bleacher Creatures section.
Whoa.
I was wearing a Pedro shirt. The only reason that I didn't get a lot of crap was that I was in the very last row, so people couldn't see me.
Oh yeah.
But then I was in right field, so the second he hit that ball, I could say, okay, this is gone. So I already started walking down the aisle, and these people just jumped in front of me, and they're just like, all they were yelling is, this is the greatest city in the world!
Yeah.
I was like, well, I live here, so I mean, I'm into that.
Yeah.
But the best story I have like this is that same night. So I used to live in Harlem, and it was, it's close to the stadium. So I was out the door, I was walking back to my apartment before probably anyone else had even left the stadium. And this guy just pulls up in his car. He pulls up to me. I'm walking in the street, and he just pulls up, rolls down his window, and he goes, you got the wrong shirt. And he just drives away. And I was like, I was crushed. I was like, wow, that was it. I do. Right now I have the wrong shirt. And then the next year happened, and ever since then, it's been no one has told me I've had the wrong shirt.
Wow. That's I remember, not to change the topic, I just remember being as crushed as I've ever been at that game. And I was not at that game, but by that game. And I was able to turn the television off. I mean, I never saw the ball land. I just turned the TV off. I can't imagine having to watch it live and then walk through a sea of Yankee fans at Yankee Stadium.
But the only good thing about it was that I rode the train by myself, because literally no one else left the stadium. It was less bad than I was also at the game, the Jeter jumping into the stands game.
Oh, good.
Where Flaherty, you know, that game went forever. Now, that game, you'd get on the train, and everyone is leaving at the same time. Like, ah, you suck, you know. But at least for the Aaron Boone game, at least until the guy pulled up on the side of the road, I was left to just be in my cocoon of just shock.
Good God. Have you ever been to a good Red Sox game? Like, Red
yeah.
Sox? Have you ever
yeah,
seen
I'm,
ever?
Yeah, I saw my. Well, here's another bad one. Pedro struck out 17 twice in his career. Once was against the Yankees in the game we all know. The other was against the Rays and Steve Traxel, and they lost. Ian Fenway. I was at that one. My favorite quirky Red Sox game I've been to was in Fenway. They won 3-2 on back-to-back home runs from Darren Lewis and Jeff Fry,
okay.
And they hit a total of 3 home runs all year.
Wow!
So that was cool.
Jeff Fry.
Yes, yes, and Darren Lewis.
Yeah, so that's actually how I know that it's officially spring or summer. Is the first time that I'm at Fenway and I see a Jeff Fry shirt, because there are still dudes in Boston who wear them.
That's amazing.
I've only seen
It's great.
I've only seen one game at Yankee Stadium with the Red Sox. I've been to Yankee Stadium a number of times, but I've only seen the Red Sox play there once, and it was in 2005. And the Red Sox happened to win 17-1. I'm looking it up now. This was
I was at that game.
Were you really?
Yeah, I remember, because it cleared out. I was like, this is great. They just kept scoring.
Yes.
That was awesome.
That was Matt Clement against Carl Pavano.
Oh God.
And she was my girlfriend at the time, and I were there. We were in the upper deck behind home plate, we were not all the way at the top, but we were close. There was a couple rows behind us, and immediately behind us was a young boy and his mother, and I don't know how old he was, 7, 8, maybe 9, and up through about the fifth inning where they left, because the score was like 12-0 at that point, he heckled me brutally, just next to his mom. He's sitting there next to his mom. He's like poking me in the back and like, Red Sox suck. Like, wow. Like, fuck you, little dude. And also, fuck your mom for being a jerk. But anyway.
See, you'd fit in here. That's
I did live in New York for a year.
There you go.
So yeah. Anyway, I think we're up against it. So I want to say thank you, Brian, for coming on the podcast and gracing us with your presence.
Thank you. The pleasure was all mine.
Excellent. I want to say also that if you're so inclined, you can go on iTunes, I think, and find our podcast and say nice things about it, give us stars, and do other stuff like that. I understand that there's an issue with the iTunes link from Blog Talk Radio, and I'm endeavoring to fix that problem, but these things take time because they're not up to me. So that'll do it, I guess, for us. And we will be back to talk more Red Sox at some point in the near future. So thank you for listening. Bye. Bye.